You're listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast from Judicial Watch.
I'm Chris Farrell, and this is On Watch. Welcome to On Watch, everybody, the Judicial Watch podcast, where we go behind the scenes to cover news stories that the mainstream media probably doesn't want you to know about, where we try to recover some lost history and explain the inexplicable. We appreciate you taking time to join us, whether you're watching on the video version of this podcast or listening on one of the streaming platforms like Spotify. Please be sure to subscribe to On Watch, leave us a rating, and then communicate with us. Let us know what you'd like us to cover, what topics, who you'd like us to interview. We appreciate your time, and we want your input. And we value all the supporters of Judicial Watch out there who day after day have been loyal to us and have helped advance this podcast to really spread out and gain incredible viewership and listenership. So thank you very much. We appreciate it. Today, I'm very pleased to be joined by a guest who has, I think, some really crucial key insights into the consequences of President Biden's unrestricted open borders on their southern border and what that means to average Americans. You see a lot of headlines, you see imagery of crises at the border with waves of people entering, Border Patrol, all the different law enforcement and social services groups trying to handle the crisis. But there's another part of the border and immigration crisis that doesn't get as much attention. It gets sporadic, intermittent attention, but it doesn't get a real focus that it should. And so, today, to address exactly that, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Don Rosenberg. Don, welcome to On Watch.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Don, you're the founder of an organization called Advocates for Victims of Illegal Immigration Crime. There's certainly been a lot of attention paid to that, again, sporadically, but most recently with the case of the young nursing student in Georgia, Laken Riley. But she's really one name out of literally thousands of people who've been the victims of illegal immigration crime. How is it that you came to found this organization?
Well, a little over 13 years ago, my son was in law school in San Francisco. He was going home one evening to his apartment, and an illegal alien tried to make a last-second left-hand turn and collided with my son. Had he stopped, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today because they were both going very slowly. But he tried to flee, and he drove back and forth over his body three times trying to get away.
Oh, my God.
And killed him. And ironically, even though he was in the country illegally, and we were told that, when we met with the police department, they had confirmed that. But then a couple of days later, they called and said, oh, there was a mistake. He's in the country legally. So for the first 11 months, I mean, you know, weird things were happening in the legal case. And over the next 11 months, I was really advocating against getting people without driver's licenses off the road because I thought the guy was here legally. I did a lot of radio shows, some TV shows locally. And I got contacted one night by an ICE agent surreptitiously who said, you know, I hear you all the time. And I got to tell you, Roberto Gallo is in the country illegally. and he did prove himself, you know, yeah, he definitely was an ICE agent. And right. That was definitely the case.
Right.
And even at that point, I still, for the next couple months, tried to stay away from the immigration part of the equation since, you know, I am in California and people don't want to hear that. But it got to the point where when I was both testifying at commission hearings and things, where people were sort of justifying illegal aliens driving, even though I never mentioned the word illegal alien, because they had to get to work, they had to get to school, they had to take their kids to the doctor. And it was sort of like, yeah, we're sorry. I mean, one person even said this to me at a LA Police Commission hearing after I testified. He said, well, I'm sorry your son died, but you know Jose has to get to work.
This is an incredibly cold and not just insensitive, but really a brutalist mentality that doesn't take into account somehow the loss of human life is equated to somebody making their daily trip to work. I mean, this is, it's completely out of touch with reality.
Yeah, well, and I got a lot of that. At one point in Los Angeles, they tried to, well, they actually ended up doing it. It was called Special Order 7, which if you were here illegally, you were allowed to drive without a license. It was eventually ruled unconstitutional, but it did go into effect. And one of the police commissioners, after I was done testifying, said, "Have you, to me, have you no compassion?"
And my answer is no, I don't.
Well, I mean, even though I had done things publicly and other, you know, parts of my career and everything, I was so stunned by it, I didn't say anything. Now, today, if somebody said that to me, I would have, you know, verbally torn them to pieces, maybe physically as well.
Right.
But it was just, it was so outrageous a comment to me. Have I no compassion? But more and more, as I kept talking and people kept telling me all the great things, even though I was still talking about unlicensed drivers, all the great things that illegal aliens had done and do. And my background, I do have some background in statistical analysis. So I started looking at the studies they were quoting and realized this is nonsense. This is not true. And they sort of forced me into the immigration issue because I had to defend that before I could even defend the not driving without a license part.
And I think for context, it's important to note you're not a professional activist. You're not a public policy wonk who's been running around, you know, dealing with these issues for your entire adult life. By profession, You're an entertainment and publishing guy. That was your professional life up to this point. And it was only the circumstances of the death of your son that even brought you into this arena at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always been a news junkie, and I'm probably one of those people that, you know, maybe I was 2 or 3 inches deep and 100 miles wide as opposed to 1 inch deep.
Sure.
So, no, you're absolutely right. I got more sucked into this. I mean, first of all, if the guy had just taken the penalty, if he didn't fight the case, this could have ended in, I mean, he would have gotten a year in jail. In California, that means 6 months maximum.
Max, right. Yeah,
he ended up getting convicted and spent 43 days in jail and released him. But if this happened at the beginning, I would have never gotten more involved. It was only as things kept happening and I kept, you know, like, why did this happen? What is going on here? What is going on there? So I kept getting deeper and deeper into this, you know, Pandora's box. And I realized how bad the situation really was. It wasn't an aberration that this guy killed somebody. And I will tell you something. He wasn't a bad guy. He was probably 50 years old. He wasn't, I know he didn't go out that day thinking, oh, I want to kill somebody.
But just to note, however, if this guy made a bad decision, took a bad act, I get it. He's not some kind of career criminal who's been running around assaulting people but there are people like the guy who killed Kate Steinle, who was a career criminal, who was a multiple felon, and they treat that kind of guy virtually the same.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, I discovered as I started doing a lot of research, getting a lot of statistics, that this is a big problem. I mean, there's no group, other than maybe criminals themselves, there's no group that you can say, oh, all of these people are murderers and rapists and whatever. But the numbers that I found, and one of the great, if people really ever want to look at some numbers, because they don't keep records on illegal alien crime like they do most other crime, but the GAO has released 3 reports over the last 20 years where they compiled data over years. And the last one was released in 2018, covering up to 2016, like 6 years. You're talking about, like your opening statement, we're talking about since, you know, if we go back to the last Immigration Act in 1986,
right,
probably close to 100,000 people have been killed by illegal aliens. About 1 million have been raped or are, you know, sexually assaulted. And if you count, you know, all the other crimes, you're talking millions and millions of crimes. So it doesn't matter whether 100% of the people are committing those crimes of illegal aliens, 50%, 10%, 5%. That's unacceptable.
Yes.
And the only way you stop that is stopping illegal aliens entering the country and deporting the ones who are here because they came in under false pretenses.
Right.
We have no idea who is a criminal past the fact that they came in illegally and who has any intention of what they come here when they come here. So all you can do is say you can't come that way. And if you're here, you have to leave.
You're exactly right. I mean, I think there's a certain perspective that's lost on some people because, look, there's an awful lot of people who are very compassionate, and I get it. They say, look, these are just people who are trying to come here for a better life. They're victims of circumstance and situation, and they're looking for economic freedom, the opportunity for prosperity. I get it. But there's a process and a system, and they choose not to follow it. And then they enter the country unlawfully. And then very shortly after that, they often obtain documentation that's, again, illegal. It's unlawful. It's false documentation in order to obtain some kind of status or then go on to get a job, whether they're using somebody else's Social Security number or whatever. Now you're getting into identity theft. And I mean, so this has a cascading effect. And so we're not talking necessarily about crimes of violence against persons or property, but we are talking about sort of a culture or an environment, an environment of criminality where they can't cross the border unless they pay the cartels a percentage. Then they get here, and it's a series of lesser criminal acts to sustain their operations here. And even if they're not, you know, axe murderers, the whole thing is predicated on illegality. So I agree with your assessment that, you know, and when you look at the numbers, as you pointed out, of crimes against persons and other violent crimes, you know, robbery and such, it's breathtaking. It's staggering. I love that your website, and so the website for folks, we'll link this in the show description so folks can go to it. But the organization, again, is Advocates for Victims of Illegal Immigration Crime. The website has tremendous resources, excellent reporting, lots of statistics, lots of reports, and then other commentary stuff as well to kind of give you a perspective. So I don't mean to interrupt you, but I just think there's some key pieces of the story that people need to really, they need to look at the full picture. There's the immigration crime, but then there's an entire environment of criminality that is the foundation, it's the predicate for this entire thing.
Right. Just one thing, if someone's trying to, you know, search us, it's Advocates for Victims of Illegal Alien Crime.
I'm sorry, illegal alien crime, I misspoke.
Yeah. We try to get as much information as we can onto the site. I mean, it's interesting, you talked about, you know, at the beginning, you know, the media doesn't want to cover this stuff. And their vetting process for an employee, no matter how low on the totem pole, is much stronger than is being done right now with the people we're allowing into the country.
Right.
And even if the person's only crime is how they come into the country, and everything you said is right, it's almost impossible to that be your only crime. But even if it is, the cost to U.S. taxpayers is staggering. You know, you always hear this they come here and they're contributing to the economy. Well, contributions can be both negative and positive.
And that's one way to put it, yeah.
You know, well, it's like the guy who sends, you know, a charity a check for 50 cents. Well, it cost the charity $3 to process the 50-cent check.
Right.
They'd rather not have it, and maybe they don't process it anyway.
Yeah.
Well, here you have a case where it's about a 10-to-1 ratio of what they contribute to what they cost. You know, when COVID started and Gavin Newsom wanted to give illegal aliens, you know, some money since the federal government wouldn't, he made a, you know, comment that, oh, they pay $2.5 billion a year in taxes. Well, I'll give him that. I mean, I have no idea where he gets his numbers, but fine. They cost California about $30 billion a year. It's over $20 billion just to educate their children. So they're not doing anything illegal about sending their kid to school, but it costs a lot of money. Right now we pay about $25,000 a year, you know, for a child K through 12. The average illegal alien maybe makes $40,000 a year. So how much in taxes is he paying? Where one kid, give him health insurance now, you know, by the, and if they're a citizen, if they were born here, you're talking probably about, it costs us probably $40,000-$50,000 a year to support this one child. And most of them have more than one child.
Sure. So, and then you take in the other factors, such as housing and health care, other social services, that number spirals upwards. And it's not just a matter of education, but it's the entire kind of social fabric and network around that. It's quite expensive. And, you know, I have a unique position, I'm originally a New Yorker, and a very dear friend of mine did not flee New York. He's there in a very senior law enforcement position. And, you know, he tells me what his officers are dealing with when it comes to the influx of people in the city of New York and how Mayor Adams is dealing with it and how a lot of the mood in New York City is turning. All of a sudden, people are saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, when your kid's school is closed and they're sent back to COVID-era Zoom classes because the school's being used to house and service illegal aliens, that has a tendency to make people kind of go, hey, wait a minute, right? All of a sudden, the local middle school is not a middle school anymore. And there's just there's a wave of complications on top of it's sort of all the unintended or unanticipated consequences that come from this. So I have to ask you, you're sitting in California now, and I'm sure that, you know, from your days of being in the entertainment industry and publishing industry, particularly in California, there's probably some old friends and colleagues who say to you, Don, what happened? Why did you, I guess they understand obviously the tragedy of your son's death, but how do they interact with you? How do they sort of process or engage with you now because you had a career going one way and now you're a pretty strong proponent in the other direction?
Well, you know, most of them, you know, especially years ago when I, you know, have these conversations, they've been, you know, they listen to the media, and at the start, yes, very sorry for what happened. Look, many of the people knew my son.
Right.
I was pretty high up in the food chain and dealt with people that were also high up. And many of them lived in the same area where I live. And, you know, we'd get together in non-business things. So they knew Drew.
Right.
And while they were, you know, and most of them came to his funeral. So while they were very, you know, touched and saddened by what happened, they looked at it as an anomaly. Yes, it's a terrible thing that happened, but, you know, what do we do about it?
They believe it's rare, which it's not.
Yes, right. And the ones that, you know, that I've been able to have long conversations with over the years have a, you know, very different position now. They, you know, because they know me, they know that I'm not feeding them a line. And, you know, if they ask me, where did you get that information? I give them the source and
right.
tell them, you know, here, you can go find it. It's not, you know, and it's not, and I'm not being derogatory to Fox News, but I don't, you know, my sources are typically government sources. I'm not going to quote, you know, people that have an agenda, whether it's good or bad or whatever it is. That's not what I do.
Yeah.
So, you know, but it's still, well, there's so many other issues that we're against the Republican Party, which is for that issue, that, you know, I still have to vote this way. And as you were saying, in New York, it'll be interesting to see how many of those people say, okay, now that it's impacting me directly,
right, right,
I've got an issue with this, and I'm going to go the other way. But a lot of it's, look, it's all media driven. You mentioned, you know, Lake and Riley at the beginning. The Los Angeles Times never printed the story at all.
Yeah. That's a trick. That's a trick of sort of the propagandistic news cycle or news system that we're in, that if you don't report on it, it never happened.
Right. And a lot of it is lies of omission.
Right.
Right. We're just not, but, you know, and I follow this pretty closely, and I particularly with the LA Times, because that's where I live.
Sure.
And, you know, I looked at the paper over the, you know, when should this article have run and what else ran as opposed to this? The story, the day it should have run, there was a pretty big story in the front section, not the front page, but the front section of the newspaper on a kid in high school who was being forced to cut his hair. Does that, and like you said, I was in publishing. How could you possibly, who's the editor that made the decision that said, let's go with this story and right, not this one?
Well, I think recently we've seen some reporting, an op-ed piece written by an editor at NPR, where I think he pulled back the veil or the curtain and said, look, and he's reporting about the National Public Radio office in D.C. and says, we've got a staff of 89 people. Every single one of the 89 is a registered Democrat, and most of them are active giving dollars to candidates. And the total number of Republicans is zero. That's a pretty hothouse environment. You know, this is a... But like you said, there's the editor at the LA Times saying, don't report on this case. Instead, you know, do this sort of frivolous piece that... But people, they're making decisions to do that. That's what disturbs me. This is not an accident or an oversight. They're making decisions to do these things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, having been a publisher, you only have so much space.
Right.
Even if you have an online component, you only have so many people to write the stories to go there. So
right,
there's limitations, and you have to pick and choose. But some things are very simple. And the murder of a young woman on a college campus by an illegal alien who was caught in New York and released,
right,
was caught in Georgia and released. That's a story that there is no decision over that. There
right,
were probably half of the stories that day in the paper. This one would have, outshined
right,
that one.
Right. And a particularly.
So the thing. Right. So the media, I blame the media more than I blame the politicians. We expect politicians to lie. We expect them to, go after the money and whatever. The whole reason behind journalism is to control them from doing that.
Correct.
And instead, we're supporting them to do that with the media, the way the media has taken positions on issues, which they have no business doing. You're not a journalist when you take a position.
Yeah, I taught journalism law at George Mason University here in Virginia for 5 years. And sadly, I had innumerable instances and examples to use in class. And of course, I was kind of the token conservative on the faculty. But I would go into class and say, let's try to, and I'll cut both ways. Judicial Watch, we are equal opportunity offenders. We're philosophically conservative, but nobody's got a monopoly on corruption. So if they're a Republican or a Democrat, we're happy to go after them. So it's not a strictly partisan issue. But, you could go through and point out stories and how they were covered or not covered, or the use of language, right? the use of language is always a wonderful example in controlling language and terminology and those sorts of things. That's another trick, another technique in the world of publishing as to what phrases are used and how they're used. And you see this on television now all the time with the same talking heads use the same lingo and same expressions. They've been emailed the talking points for that day and they're working off of them. So it's not like there's a lot of original thinking going on. But Don, I want to go back to something. So you're in this position where you've lost your son. You're frustrated by the lying and the double talk and the yes but no and no but yes. And it's kind of like they're playing three-card Monty with you, right? You're supposed to guess what the truth is. But then you go from that experience to founding, and I'm going to say the name right this time, Advocates for Victims of Illegal Alien Crime. But you found this organization. So take us from, you know, mourning father to I got to do something about this. Walk us through that.
Okay. Well, for years, I was kind of, you know, somewhat doing this on my own. I would reach out frequently when I did get a story of someone who, you know, had just suffered a tragedy. I would try to connect with the person as quickly as possible. You know, just to give them a little both moral support and tell them what happened in my case and how the system was working. And what I learned as I was meeting some of these people and talking to them was it didn't matter whether it was a conservative area or a liberal area. The district attorneys or prosecutors, you know, whatever they were called, they want to get rid of these cases as fast as they can. They don't want to deal with them.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, the group got a little bigger and bigger. We ended up, you know, going to D.C. at various times to testify, meet with people. And a core of us said, you know, maybe it's time to form an organization. Maybe an organization will give us a little more strength. Plus the fact there were a couple of organizations out there, and I'm not demeaning any of them, but they weren't run by victims.
Right.
You know, I mean, some were professionals, some weren't, some were just, you know, somebody who had taken an interest. You know, so we started, you know, we talked about starting AVIAC, finally did in June of 2017. And I do need to give a call out to one of your people. Robert Stick became our attorney.
He's a very good man and a very good friend. Yes, indeed.
And he still is. And he has been incredibly helpful, and I mean, so I just did want to give him a plug. You know, so what ended up happening, because we really started talking about this probably in early fall of 2016. So of course, Trump gets elected president, and all of a sudden we have a friend in the White House, and we have, you know, the ability to talk to people in government that we never had before.
Right.
As an individual, you know, we weren't a group at the time. So, you know, we formed the group, and, you know, we're still going. We our main objective, because the one thing that I found and that we found that everybody we talked to that was a victim basically got screwed by the system, and typically early on, and it impacted how their case went.
Yes.
And that was anywhere from what the person was charged with, people being released and fleeing.
Right.
I mean, these things that are like that you need to know the first week after this happens. And it's hard to do that when you're in such shock.
Sure.
But these things were happening and, you know, we wanted to stop them. And we were doing that for a while. It's become impossible now under both the Biden administration, lack of cooperation. And the fact that the media doesn't even, you know, rarely covers these cases anymore. You mentioned, you know, Kate Steinle.
Sure.
And then Lake and Riley. Well, I used to have you know, when people would talk to me about Kate Steinle and the organization hadn't started yet, my comment was, well, half the people think she's the first person ever killed by an illegal alien, and the other half right. never heard of her.
Right. Exactly correct.
Well, today on Lake and Riley, I would say 80% of the people, you know, never heard of her. And the 20% that did think she's the first person that was ever killed by an illegal alien. So it's, we also wanted to, you know, how do we get our voice heard? How do we influence things? So we've spent a lot more time, you know, meeting with politicians, because like I said, it's so hard. You know, we find out about these tragedies, typically death, but it could be 4 months after it happens, at which point the cast is, you know, the die has been cast as to how that person's going to be treated. And we still will reach out, just as if you want to talk to somebody who's been through this,
sure,
and is past the shock, you know, here we are. But we more now, you know, will deal with politicians. You know, we write lots of emails to the news media, you know, typically trying to correct factual statements they make that aren't factual.
Well, that goes back to the control of language issue I spoke about a moment ago. There's a lexicon of approved words and phrases, and almost all the reporting is skewed, you know?
And they, very few will ever respond. I mean, it's not, you know, I don't want to give anybody my opinion unless they ask for it. So it's, you know, you said this, but here's the truth. I mean, even before I got, you know, before we came on here, I was looking at a column that was, it's in the LA Times, where the writer is accusing Trump of, you know, please don't call them animals. Now, he did say that, but he was talking about illegal aliens. But her article says, quote, that was Trump last week in Grand Rapids, Michigan, talking about immigrants. No, he wasn't talking about it. Illegal aliens are not immigrants.
Correct.
And that's a point we try to push as a group constantly, is there's a difference. You don't become an immigrant when you step over the border illegally. You don't become an immigrant when your visa expires. You don't become an immigrant requesting asylum, and you certainly don't become an immigrant when that asylum claim is denied and you refuse to leave.
Right.
So, you know, don't do that. And I tell you, I testified in July at a House Judiciary Committee hearing. And, you know, everybody always has a theme. So the Democrats' theme that point was, don't demonize immigrants. And what I tried to say, and it's a little hard because you can't speak unless you're spoken to. What I tried to say is, you're the one, to the Democrats, you're the ones demonizing immigrants by combining them with criminals.
Correct.
We're not doing that. I'm not talking about immigrants. I'm fine. And a matter of fact, my son Drew, who was killed and in law school, you know, you never know till it happens, but when he did a semester overseas, he met a girl that he would have probably married. She would have been an immigrant. My other son married a first generation American, and, you know, her father is an immigrant. So I don't even want to connect. The two should not be connected at all.
Right.
That's what they do, because they want to make criminals look better than they are, so they connect them with the people who followed the legal path.
Right. Their whole objective is just to blur it all up.
Yes.
And,
right.
And make it as sensationalized in the way of saying, you know, like, you basically, you know, by what you're saying, you're attacking my grandmother, right? And it's like, no, no one's trying to attack your grandmother,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that is not the issue at all. But they enjoy that kind of ambiguity. It's strategic. They deliberately blur it up and try to mix and match. And it's a dishonest effort on their part. And they know better, which is even, I mean, these are not stupid people. They very well what they're doing. And that's.
But you know what? They've been very successful.
They have.
Been extremely successful, because when you know, again, speaking as a publisher, we used to have a saying, don't argue with the guy who owns the ink.
Right.
And it's, you know, when you're trying to fight one person writing something and millions of people are seeing or hearing something, you know, one of the things that was interesting right after the State of the Union address, I mean, you know, you talked about your friends in New York and everything. And obviously, we're seeing people, you know, in much greater numbers being against illegal immigration. But right after the State of the Union thing, there was an article in the paper, and they were just, you know, showing the rankings and the, you know, viewership. And you always hear the left complaining about Fox News, like they're lying and poisoning everybody, and that's why people are against illegal immigration. Well, I looked at that, and Fox was the number one, you know, they had the most viewers by one outlet. They had about 7%. But then when you look at CBS, NBC, ABC, MSNBC, CNN, on and on,
right,
they had about 25%.
Right.
So it was more than three times as many. And then I went back and looked at newspapers that endorse, you know, in 2020.
Right.
And, you know, 44 papers out of the top 100 endorse Biden, 7 endorse Trump, and the others didn't endorse anybody. So the news media is, in numbers, is clearly on the other side of this issue than I am.
Yeah.
So you know, and that's why people have such a false impression of what's really happening. So, you know, they know illegal immigration is bad. They don't know what to do about the people that are here.
And, you know, and it's not going away anytime soon. I mean, this is now a generational problem. And even the folks that are, you know, if your last name is Mayorkas, you know, it's still a problem, and it's going to have to be dealt with. These people are not just suddenly going to vanish into thin air. Trump's talked about deportation. That's going to be a neat trick. Maybe get away with it, you know, in large part or in small part, or maybe incrementally. But there are real consequences. There are real sort of circumstances that we have to deal with now, and we're going to have to deal with for the next 5-10 years. There's no magic wand solution to this, and the crime numbers are outrageous.
Yeah, I think you're being generous. 5 to 10 years. I think if everything was done the way it should be done, and we sealed the border, we stopped, you know, we started, you know, deporting people that are here illegally, 20, 30 years from now, there's still going to be stories of illegal aliens killing people and committing crimes. Because no matter how hard you try to do it, it's almost an impossible task. It doesn't mean you don't stop, but, you know, it's like speeders. You can't stop them from speeding.
Right.
You control it to some extent. The problem is the Democrats think, oh, you can stop speeding. Just raise the speed limit to 100 miles an hour and there's no more speeding. And that's what they're doing. Oh, just let the people in legally,
yeah,
and then we have no more problem with illegal immigration.
Let me ask you a question. So we got somebody who's watching this or listening to it on the audio version, and they're motivated. They are fed up. Maybe they know somebody. Maybe, you know, a relative or the person down the street or a guy at work, you know, he's had a family member who's been assaulted or some other very unfortunate situation. And they say, okay, that's it. I listened to this podcast. I heard this guy, Don. He's telling a story. And they're motivated to do something. What are your recommendations? What John Q. Citizen sitting out there, seeing the news, hearing us, says, okay, I've had enough. What do they do? What's the next step? How do you be positive about this?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, one thing, they should contact us, and you're going to have, you know, it's aviac.us, aviac.us. They can contact us, and from there, they can contact me directly. I respond to everyone, typically with a phone call. But the other thing they need to do is they need to write to their congressman and senator. They need to write to their local politicians. They need to tell their friends to write, their friends to call. There has to be a massive amount of pressure put on, particularly, you know, purple politicians that feel they need to address this issue.
Right.
Because I have a belief that if you could take, like, let's say HR 2, And if you could take an anonymous vote on H.R. 2, it would overwhelmingly pass the House and Senate.
I agree.
And many Democrats would vote for it if they didn't have attached, and we know that's not going to happen, but if they didn't have to attach their name to it, because they know they'll be destroyed if they did. And, you know, the few that are in very, very safe districts, you know, they may come out and say something, but, you know, they still may not vote. So these people have to feel that I'm going to lose if I don't address this issue. And the same thing, you know, write to your local newspapers. Let them see. They probably won't print your letter, but let them see there are more people out there than they think are. You know, I've written a lot of op-eds, particularly the LA Times. They never run them. Some occasionally they'll run one of my letters. And then, you know, if I speak to somebody, they'll say, well, we don't get that many letters or op-eds from your side of the issue. And it's like, yeah, because you would never run them. I haven't
surprise, surprise.
One.
Yeah.
Well, it takes a long time to write a good op-ed unless you're an incredible writer, which, you know, I'm not. So how much time am I going to waste sending something? I'll tell you a quick story that I did get, you know, somewhat friendly with the guy who was the editor of the opinion page. He's not anymore. And when California was, you know, becoming a sanctuary state, I wrote an op-ed and I said to him, look, can you do me a favor? Just, I'm going to send this to the woman who runs the op-ed page, but could you just send it to her as well? Just, you know, whatever. So he said, yeah, sure. So I sent it to her, I sent it to him. 15 minutes later, I get a response from her. This is, you know, an excellent op-ed, but we're already considering other op-eds on the sanctuary state thing. Okay, I mean, I kind of expected that. So what ends up happening, they run three op-eds supporting sanctuary state. They run one that kind of explained, it was sort of neutral explaining what sanctuary state was.
Yeah.
And of course, every article in the paper was supporting. It's like, so okay, if it was so excellently written, then the only reason you didn't run it is because you don't want anybody to see what I've had to say.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to make it look like, you know, and this is sanctuary. We want to save, you know, Jose the gardener and Maria the housekeeper from being deported.
Right.
And no, sanctuary has nothing to do with them. It has everything to do with protecting criminal illegal aliens.
Right, who actually have super citizen rights, right? They have rights above and beyond anything that you or I, and we could do the exact same thing, the exact same unlawful act, they would walk and you and I would be sitting in the jail till we got an attorney, had an arraignment, made bail, and got out, right?
Absolutely.
3 days later.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's the craziness.
That what I mentioned at the beginning, the Special Order 7, which was to allow illegal aliens to drive, statistically, about half and half at the time, I'm not sure what it is today, you know, about half the people that were driving without a license were illegal and they, you know, weren't allowed to get one. And the other half were American citizens who had their licenses suspended or revoked for, you know, driving drunk, you know, whatever the case. So it was about a 50-50. But the Special Order 7 only protected those who were here illegally, not those, because some of the people on that other side, they didn't pay child support, so they had their license revoked. Well,
right.
It didn't mean they were a bad driver.
Right.
And maybe that would have been a good penalty, but it wasn't that, oh, well, you're a bad driver, you're a drunk driver. No, you were fine. So yes, there's clearly that they are a special class. They become a special class that has better protection than the citizens.
Ordinary citizens.
They're right. Completely law-abiding.
Right.
Absolutely.
So the organization is Advocates for Victims of Illegal Alien Crime. The founder is our guest today, Don Rosenberg. Don, I'm going to give you the last word. Anything that I should have asked that I didn't, or something that you think is particularly important, I'm going to turn this over to you to kind of do a little recap and finish up.
Well, you know, one of, and this is probably what I think is one of the most important things, other than, you know, what I said about writing and speaking out and, you know, to people, is that we don't want to demonize illegal aliens either. We want to demonize the process. We want to demonize, you know, what they've done, not necessarily who they are. Because as you mentioned earlier, yeah, there are a lot of people that come here looking for a better life. And, you know, there are valid reasons that they would want to come, but not a valid reason to be allowed, you know, to enter. And every time people speak out so negatively, and, you know, Donald Trump is one of the, you know, besides the fact that he gets heard more often, one of the worst offenders, is that it turns off those independent people that we could win over if the conversation, you know, here's a case where the truth is bad enough. You don't have to go further. And like his comment that I mentioned earlier about animals, to me, you know, and I would get blasted if anybody would listen to me here, is I think there that those people, the ones that are out, you know, that are committing all these crimes, it's demeaning to animals to say that they're animals. Well, let's face it, animals do not
I
kill
get
for
it.
sport,
I get it. Yeah,
you know.
but I
So
mean, it's the off the cuff expression from a 74-year-old New York real estate developer. I mean, that's you have to contextualize this, right?
right. So you can, you know, say how bad they are, say how much crime, how many crimes they commit. Be all you have, like I said, all you have to do is be honest and state the facts. When you start name calling, and again, like the article I said, you're going to get quoted in the paper that all immigrants, he didn't
Yeah,
say that. I mean, all you have to
it
go back
becomes a
and listen.
distraction. I agree. I
Right.
agree.
So it's just, you know, be careful what you say, but be strong about what you say and have the facts. You don't need to go overboard, because the winner of the election in November is going to be the guy who gets the most independents. The bases are going to go where they go, and neither side has enough of a base to win the election on their own. So that's where, you know, and those people don't want to hear that, because, you know, again, being from, or not being from Southern California, but living here for 35 years, most people's experience with illegal aliens is a good one. Oh, they come out, they mow my lawn, they do it cheap, they're very nice, they work hard, it's 100 degrees, they're out. Now, you know, who knows what else they're doing, and I don't even want to, you know, I wouldn't want to try to, you know, say anything about that. But the thing is, so when you tell somebody that, oh, these people are animals, it's like, no, this guy's been mowing my lawn for 10 years, and they're all nice people. So it's a tough juxtaposition to convince that person that they're bad. And when they don't read about any of the bad things out here in the LA Times or see it on the news, and you can spread that nationwide, they don't believe what's being said. So all I would say is be honest, and, you know, the truth is more than enough to make people realize this is not a sustainable policy to allow these people to come here and to allow the ones that are here to stay. The
Don
law has to be
Rosenberg,
enforced.
I appreciate all that you've done. You certainly have the sympathy of Judicial Watch and my colleagues and my good friend Robert Sticht on your loss, but you've taken a loss and you've tried to turn it around and you've tried to come up with a positive solution that calls for accountability and respect and dignity for human life and for law-abiding citizens to do the right thing. So we thank you for taking time joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Chris, thank you so much for having me. I can't bring my son back to life, but I want to try to, you know, stop this from happening to anybody else.
Don Rosenberg, you're a good man, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I'm Chris Farrell on Watch.
Thanks for listening to Chris Farrell's On Watch podcast. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.